Welcome to Management Matters, the award-winning National Academy of Public Administration podcast where policy meets practice. I'm Terry Girton, president of the Academy. March is Women's History Month. In this episode, I'll talk with Academy Fellow Dr. Karen Hardy, globally recognized enterprise risk management expert and the author of Flip This Risk, book series and podcast about her fascinating career. Karen, thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, Terry, thank you. I'm excited to be here today with you.
Well, let's start with that enterprise risk management. As I said, you're a recognized expert in the field. Help us understand in practical terms what enterprise risk management really is all about.
Well, that's a great question, Terry. So let's just do something here. Let's just imagine that you're a chief information officer, right? Mm-hmm. And within your CIO organization, you're having daily conversations about risk and opportunities and threats that impact what you do as your work as a CIO. But so you use all of this information that you're gathering and this data, and you're using it to help inform your decision making regarding your strategy, your objectives, your goals. But the only thing is, you're not sharing that information with anyone else within the organization. So imagine if other C-suite leaders did the same thing. They were looking at within their organizations, looking at the threats and opportunities and risks that associate with what they do, but they're not really sharing that information with anyone outside of the organization. And what enterprise risk management does, it really creates this collective conversation of all C-suite leaders, for example, and they get to talk about the risk collectively, not just what you know is a risk, but how does the way you manage your risk impact the way I manage my organization? So it really creates the community conversation whereby it's not a subjective view of risk. It really elevates it from a linear conversation to one that is more exponential and to understand how it impacts the organization as a whole, not just from where you sit within an organization.
So in the world today, if every single person around the table brought their list of 15 to 20 major risks, that could get overwhelming really quickly. How do organizations kind of get a handle on that, prioritize, and take action?
Well, the key to actually doing, and you're right, it can be overwhelming. You can imagine hundreds, thousands of risks you could just bring it up there. So you have to have business rules. Everything can't make that high-level conversation, and that's where government has been able to develop methodologies and processes to help neck those risks down. And that's the framework that has been developed over the years that a lot of the agencies actually use to solve that problem.
So we're going to dig into some practical examples of this, but before we do, I want to talk about you and ERM, because I don't know any five-year-olds that would say they want to be an ERM manager when they grow up.
Right.
Right? How did you get into this particular field?
It's funny. I was in the right place at the right time. Honestly, I was senior management analyst at NIH, and part of my job at that time was managing the internal control system for the National Cancer Institute. So it was because of an incident at NIH that ended up on the front page of the Washington Post where, you know, NIH decided, hey, we need to get ahead of these problems. How do we do that? So they wanted to invest in a process to help them get ahead of problems. So I happened to be in contact with the office of the director of NIH prior to that NIH incident. So when the opportunity came up to work on the team to develop NIH risk management program, I was hired for that job and was involved in developing the NIH risk management program for administration. So that's how it happened for me.
Wow. I can imagine NIH is one of those groups that brings a lot of really significant risks to the table and has to deal with those.
Yeah, 27 institutes. You have 27 institutes that make up NIH and 27 institutes with their own ideas of what the risks mean to them and different type of risks. So it was a huge operation, but it took a dedicated team and also, again, identifying a methodology and process for making it uniform across the organization.
Well, in addition to NIH, I mean, I know that you've advised the banking industry and other big agencies in the federal government on risk management. What was the toughest scenario or the biggest risk that you've ever faced?
Well, since I spent most of my time in government, one of the things I will say is that all of them are tough. Every one of them are tough.
No easy answers. Huh?
There are no easy answers there at all. And I can't spot one specific thing, because in government, most risks are common across agencies. Most of them are common. So if one agency has a cold, others will start coughing. It's that type of relationship, right? That's why we have the GAO high risk list, mm-hmm. which is issued every 2 years. It outlines several common risks impacting agencies, such as talent, retention and retirements, and maintaining seasoned contract specialists. So yeah, all of them are important. And this is just a cross-cutting view of those risks across agencies.
But yet every agency would say that their risk area is special or different.
Of course they say that. Everyone wants to be special, Terry. But you're right. Well, in some instances, that is true when it comes to specific risks, because some are very specific to agencies. For instance, I don't expect the Small Business Administration to oversee satellites. You won't see any type of satellite risk in a portfolio of SBA. Right. But you will see it in NOAA, and they manage that risk specific. But for the most part, most agencies manage common risks, human capital, IT, facilities across the board.
All right. Well, then let's go back to your NIH example, because you talked about 27 different institutes in NIH and trying to be at the table to pull all of that together. What did it take to successfully manage that risk across the enterprise?
It took a lot.
a lot of time and energy.
it took a lot of time, a lot of energy, because at that time, the learning curve for the staff was just as high for the organization. So everyone's learning at the same time, looking for best practices. And at that time, there wasn't a lot of government examples of how enterprise risk management was being implemented mm-hmm. within the agency. And we're talking about the time frame around 2005.
Okay.
So at that time, a lot of the international standards in 2009 were just getting implemented, right? Like ISO 31000. So this was brand new in a sense across the federal government. There was nothing official on paper. There's no guidance or requirements to even do enterprise risk management on paper at that particular time. So we pretty much was left at our own to do research, look to private industry, look at other maybe state and local governments that were already doing some work, but most of the things were fragmented. So we pretty much learned by doing at that particular time. So it took a lot of education, not only socializing the idea that risk isn't a bad thing, but mm-hmm. socializing the idea with senior leadership that this is something that needed to be instituted, especially at NIH, because they had the desire to get ahead of problems. And one way to do that is to think about risk proactively and not in, you know, as a rearview mirror type thing.
I love something you just said there, which was that you had to educate people that risk isn't bad. And I think that that's in the title too. We don't talk, it's not enterprise risk elimination, it's enterprise risk management. Like some of these risks are never going to go away, right? So how hard of a mindset is that to change for leaders in government organizations?
Well, I love that term mindset, because that's exactly what it is. Most of the leadership, even employees within the organization, were not accustomed to that term, because they only knew what they brought to the table from maybe personal experience, that risk is bad. Mm-hmm. And people carried those assumptions with themselves. So we had to re-educate, as you said, the mindset of leaders. We had to help them and reassure them that sharing your risk was not a bad thing. It was not, you weren't going to be punished by, disclosing that a risk is high and could be detrimental to an organization. So a lot of socialization up front is important. Even today, you need to have conversation and socialize and make sure they understand what is the notion, what is the relationship, what is the risk philosophy that the organization has? What is their philosophy regarding risk? Is it a bad thing? Is it a good thing? Is it a positive thing? That type of thing. And create an environment where people feel comfortable sharing information.
So those kind of life lessons are really important. And you talked about your NIH work kind of in the early 2000s, at the front end of the development of this field. But then you went on to be a founding member of the Association for Federal Risk Management. So with that perspective, like, what does a firm do here? And kind of what grade would you give the federal government on its risk management practices?
You know, a firm really closed the gap. It really connected the lack of expertise and knowledge to practice. Imagine a world without a firm, right? You don't have that middle person there closing and bringing together practitioners with the education and knowledge needed to carry out that within an organization. So a firm was created with about 5 to 8 of us who had the same passion. At the same time, around 2005, we were excited about the potential of actually integrating enterprise risk management within the federal government workspace. So we're very passionate. So we got together and decided, hey, if we can build this out, let's get together and talk about this and how it could impact government as a whole. So one thing led to the other. We went from 5 to 8 people to 50, and then it grew the next year, and then the next year, because the word started to spread. But also, it was timely because a lot of things in private industry were taking place, and private industry started to do more risk management and international standards were being developed. So a firm, even to this day, is here to help educate the federal government sector and local and state government on how risk can be managed effectively within the organization, how it can be beneficial in making an organization resilient through analytics and all those other things.
And so are we doing a pretty good job with it?
I would say yes, considering where it started.
Okay.
Okay. It started from a very nascent place where nothing pretty much existed. So it was really driven by the passion and heart of public servants mm-hmm. who believe that this is something that could benefit the quality of the programs that government offers its citizens. It's important to manage programs responsibly. And this is one of the ways to protect the value of those programs by instituting this practice of enterprise risk management. So grade wise, I would give it a passing grade because it has come a long way. It has come from not having a policy to having a policy. We've gone from people running from the idea of risk management because they thought we were shadow auditors, when actually we're more proactive managers, helping managers be proactive. We now have credentialing and training and all those things happening that didn't exist before. So yes, definitely a passing grade.
That's cool. Well, and I love the role that you've played in making a concept that can be overwhelming much more accessible. And one of the ways you do that is through the books and podcasts that you do. You call yourself a risk management storyteller.
Right.
As you host your Flip the Risk podcast. And I'm just really fascinated by the questions you ask in your intro about what is the relationship that high achievers have with risk taking mm-hmm. and whether it influences decision-making or resiliency. So tell us a little bit about what you've learned as in the process of telling your risk management stories.
Well, the real motivation for me doing that was this. I was just being nosy. I just want to know how people are actually thinking about risk personally and to see if there was some correlation. So that came out of my head. Okay. But I do tie it back to when we were talking about, you know, the standards, the international mm-hmm. standards. And one of the standards say that the human factor is an attribute of effective risk management. So the human factor has to be taken into consideration. How people think, their assumptions, their beliefs, their motives, all those things help to shape how they actually manage risk within the organization. So yes, I am the storyteller. I want to hear the stories of my guests, not just from in their workspace, but how they have tackled and addressed risk personally in their careers. And what I found out is very fascinating stories about themselves. It brings a whole different level of perspective that you may not think about, but it also helps you think deeper about the impacts of risk within an organization, because an organization is made up of people. So it's been very fascinating in hearing their stories about how they personally feel about risk and how they manage risk within an organization.
I'm going to ask a dangerous question, but do you have a favorite guest or story from the episodes that you've recorded?
That's a very dangerous question.
I know.
Terry, you know that's a very dangerous question. So my political answer is all of them are great, you know, guests that have been on the show, but there have been some stories that they shared that I think are very unique to the guests themselves. For instance, one time I had a Egyptologist on the show, and he unearths mummies.
Wow.
In fact, he has a show on the Discovery Channel. You may ask, what does that have to do with risk management? How is that going to have a help a risk manager do a better job? But what I learned was that he was able to show the analogy between the two fields. He says it's very risky doing that type of work, but there's a thrill at the end. You take the chance, you take the risk. You don't know what you'll find. You go through discovery, but the reward at the end is so gratifying. And for people who work in risk management, they feel the same way. You go through this, the relationships with working with your customers, your clients, you're discovering, you're creating new ways to solve problems. And the whole goal of enterprise risk management is to help solve a problem within the organization. One of the guests I had was the founder of Priceline.com.
Wow.
Yeah. And one of the biggest quotes he had was that chaos was the breeding ground for opportunity. What a great mindset to embed within your organization. Those are the type of things that you get from practitioners that you usually don't get, but you let them tell their story.
Well, I can see why you call that the risk management storyteller, because those are two fascinating examples that, you know, we might not have ever thought of.
Exactly.
So thanks for sharing those. But I also want you to tell a little bit more about your own personal story, because you have such an interesting background. And, you know, you have a doctorate, you have a career in a highly analytical field. People might think you're a very right brain thinker, but you've got a very creative side to you as well. And so I happen to know that you play the saxophone.
How did you know that, Terry?
Tell us more about your musician background.
You know, it's funny. It's just one of those things I started in my childhood. I started music in the fourth grade. Now, I don't play for an orchestra or anything like that, but it's always been a part of my life, music and music appreciation. So I started in high school writing. And rather than taking senior level English for my last year, 12th grade, I spent the whole year studying Shakespeare and attending the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. And that's where I learned about the rhythm of words, the association of words, why words matter, the way people communicate, and using imagery to help tell stories. So it was a great basis for building my communication skills that I use today. And music was just one of the creative outlets that I used to do that.
Well, and you have some work on display at the Shakespeare Theater, right?
Actually, at the Martin Luther King Jr. Library in downtown Washington, D.C., which was, I didn't know this was happening, but they actually captured the work of the students that went to that center. It's called the Lemuel Penn Center, which is now within Duke Ellington School of the Arts. But they have captured an exhibit with all the contribution the students have made. So the poetry I wrote at that time is actually captured in a small book on display in the library. And they're eventually going to make that a part of the library collection. So that's pretty cool.
That is very cool. How does your creative side play into your risk management side? How does one side reinforce the other?
You know, it's a great question, because it's a very good question, because I was just reading about this phenomenon known as golden brain. I don't know if you ever heard of it, but it suggests that people use both their right and left side of their brain equally and more often than others. It's not as if we're just one-sided. You're more right brain or left brain. It's just that maybe you just don't use the brains more often than most people. And I've come to the conclusion that I use both brains, side of my brains, a lot consistently. So in risk management, for instance, if I was to look at a heat map, you know, the three colors, red, yellow, and green, that would be interpreted on my creative side as a book cover, like Flip This Risk. I reinterpreted what I saw into some type of imagery. So that's why I could be working on both sides simultaneously, or one side other than the other. And what I found is that my right brain informs my left brain, and my left brain informs my right brain. It helps create breakthroughs that I may not get. So I spend a lot of time going between both all the time.
Do you find that you bring problems, solutions to the table when other people can't see them?
Yeah, I don't see problems the same. I don't see things the same. And I always wondered about that growing up, like, am I strange? Am I seeing something no one else sees? But yeah, I'm able to interpret things differently visually in my head. I see things in my head first, and then a manifestation that physically may be a book, may be a song, may be music, that type of thing. So it's been really a positive for me and a strong attribute for me within the field.
I think it's such a great reminder to all of us to make sure that we have diversity of thought and background at the problem-solving table so that we don't think, oh, we're dealing with risk. We need only the quantitative people at the table or whatever, that we need to make sure we have folks with wide varieties of skills and perspectives to do what you just said, to bring a really robust set of solutions to the table.
Right. The whole makeup of a chief risk officer team, for instance, is just not finance people. You definitely have to bring naysayers and data scientists and create a problem solving, visualists, all these people now make up a team because the world looks different now. We're so connected now. So we need a different way of reviewing how it should look or modeling how it should look. But the bottom line is that, you know, it's suggested that encouraging people to use both their creative and logical faculties through activities like creative expression can actually enhance leadership effectiveness.
So I'm imagining as you're coaching organizations and leaders through ERM, that that's an important lesson because it's not one that some people come by naturally.
Right. One of the things I particularly do, I do integrate transformation and mindset whenever I'm coaching or doing an online class. I'm putting that in my teachings because I think it's important to understand that risk management is not a linear profession or occupation. There's room for creativity. There's room for exploration and looking at things differently. So I think this is the perfect time now to actually begin to integrate that type of skill. And I love adding that creative touch to the practice.
It's so important. And as we're segueing a little bit into this month of women's history and sort of a national conversation about it, your background that we just sort of talked about makes you a trailblazer. And so this conversation about making sure that we have diverse perspectives at the table, have you faced any particular challenges in your career, given your gender?
Well, I'm not sure if the challenges I had were because of my gender, and I do identify as she, her. But what I do understand is that there aren't as many women represented in a lot of traditional industries like risk management or cyber or what have you, or corporate security. So when it comes to career growth, you will run into some stumbling blocks regardless, whether it's gender, education, attainment, or any other element. The key is to still show up, I think. The key to success is showing up and not being shy about wanting to be visible. You should participate. You should express your perspective and be a part of the conversation. And we have to take risk. That's what this conversation is all about. That's why your personal storytelling about risk is so important. Maybe you will be the only one. Maybe you'll be the first one. But that path has to be paved, and you should walk in your talent and abilities to make a difference. Let others see you so that they know there's a path for success in what's possible.
Do you have any mentors along the way in your career that helped you step into that talent and confidence?
Yeah, there have been a handful of people, not a lot, just a handful of people at certain points of time in my life. They either opened the door or considered me for an opportunity or were there, you know, guiding me in what my next step should be. So, yeah, having a mentor is very important, but it has to be someone who is invested in your potential and what you're able to do. It takes a special person to see something you can't see within yourself. And that's the type of mentor that you want.
Yeah, that's such a great point. because we all have the opportunity, right, to find a person out there and say, no, step into that talent, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what you want. Step into who you are. Step into your reality. Step into your authenticity. Be who you are. I think having the confidence to do that is very important. And one thing I do want to go back to, Terry, you talked about passing grade in terms of the status of enterprise risk management in government. I would say that one of the ways to grow it within government is to start adopting the knowledge and information of enterprise risk management into the public affairs and public administration curriculums. I think that's key for students to understand the reality is that you must be able to manage risk to be successful within public service. And I think there needs to be an opportunity to share content of enterprise risk management within the public administration curriculums out there. I think it takes a village to make this happen. One of the top skills that senior executives have identified to be successful as a senior executive is the ability to calculate risk. So we got plenty of risks to calculate, but we need to draw the bridge between the future leaders and make sure they understand what that entails.
That's a great point, because there's not any aspect of public administration these days that isn't suffused with risk.
Exactly.
Of all kinds. So just thinking about that, thinking about your own story, this conversation about mentorship as we kind of wrap up today, what advice do you have for those who would be considering public service as a career?
Well, you know, I didn't start in public service. I started in banking, right?
Right.
How did I end up there? And I told you that I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. I started in banking. I was in private industry, you know, where profits is the name of the game. But I would tell them what I learned by coming from private industry to public service is that you have to have a heart for service, right? Because the world is a big place and you need to have a deep understanding of how things work and how they're connected and how they can be used to solve problems. So I think it's important to understand that if you want to serve people and if you're looking for a purpose in life, government gives you that purpose because each agency has a mission. And there's so many missions that could align with what your passion is. And they should really take a moment to look at all the missions out there with the agencies that find one that really sticks with them, that really speaks to them, and then serve. It's a very fulfilling career, and they should really take advantage of it.
Well, Karen, thanks for sharing your passion with us today and opening the door a little bit to what can sometimes be a black box on enterprise risk management.
Understood.
Helping us recognize that it's everywhere, and we all have to deal with it. So really glad that you joined us today. We'll put a link in the show notes about your own book and podcast. Maybe we can mutually reinforce each other's audiences as a result of our conversation today.
Sounds like a great idea to me, Terry.
All right. Well, Karen, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
For our listeners, check back every Monday for a new episode from the Academy as we work to build a just, fair, and inclusive government that strengthens communities and protects democracy.